Thanks. Okay, on this note, perhaps we can start our briefing. I'd like to thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 22nd of October. We have a change to the agenda. We are trying to connect with our colleague from UNDP in Gaza, but we're not able to do so at the moment. We'll keep you updated on that. If should we be able to connect, we'll go straight to her. That's Ms. Noguchi, the Deputy Special Representative of UNDP. We also have another change. Rick Peppercorn, who you know well from WHO, is also in Gaza, but not able to connect, unfortunately. So our agenda has shifted a little bit, maybe, and I will introduce Ms. Bauer in a moment. We're very pleased to have you here with us, but perhaps first we'll start off with Alejandro, who you know well from UNEP, who has an announcement for us, and then we'll go over to Ms. Bauer. Alejandro.
Thank you very much, Rolando. Good morning, dear colleagues. Ahead of the UN Climate COP in Azerbaijan, in Baku, the UN Environment Program, UNEP, is about to launch, as it does every year, the Emissions Gap Report. Now, this is the 15th Emissions Gap Report that we're going to launch, and as you already know, it provides a yearly overview of the gap between the emissions, the global emissions, and where those emissions would need to be if we want to keep a limit to global warming, to the increase in global warming compared to pre-industrial times, to 1.5 degrees. In other words, it offers an overview of the gap between the ambition of the Paris Agreement on climate change and the nationally determined contributions of different countries. Now, each edition also explores ways to bridge that gap. And I should also mention that this year is special because we have a very good opportunity to see the ambition rise. We've got a new set of nationally determined contributions that are going to be presented at the next COP, the one in Brazil, in the COP30. I don't know if you remember that the last Emissions Gap Report had a very interesting title and a rather playful but sad one. Broken record, temperatures hit new highs, yet world fails to cut emissions again. What do you think the new report is going to look like? Do you think it's going to be very different to what we had last year? What temperature do you think we're heading to now? What do the current commitments look like? What temperature are we heading to even if countries do meet their commitments, their nationally determined contributions? Well, the answers to all these questions will very soon be available to you. We're going to launch the report officially on Thursday. I will send you all an email with the details for an online conference where you will be able to watch our executive director, Inger Andersen, as well as the head of the publication. But if you are really interested, there will be an embargo technical briefing tomorrow. I will also share the details online. And if you want to receive embargoed press materials, feel free to reach out to me. You have my email, but it's laguna@un.org. Thank you very much, and have a good rest of the week.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. Do we have questions? No, I think it was very clear that we look forward to that, those emails on Thursday and for the briefing tomorrow. Do register with Alejandro. Thank you once again. Okay, on this note, we shift gears. Oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry. Pardon me, before you leave, Alejandro, we have, I think Claire wanted to add something, I'm not sure who Veronique is, if you can identify yourself. Veronique, is she a colleague of yours? No? Let's maybe, I think Claire from WMO wanted to add something on this note, please.
Yeah, can you see me?
Yes, and hear you, absolutely.
Okay. Yes, sorry to butt in like this. It's not a question, but it's also just to say that following on from the Emissions Gap Report, the World Meteorological Organization will be releasing its greenhouse gas bulletin on Monday, the 28th of October, press conference at the Palais. What we report on is concentrations of greenhouse gases that stay in the atmosphere. So it's not the, you know, the net emissions, it's what is up, what stays up there after greenhouse gases have been absorbed by the oceans, by the biosphere, etc. We will send out information on that in advance, but it, you know, very much complements the emissions gap report, and it is part of the package of information which is sent to the climate change conference.
That's most helpful. Thank you very much, Claire, for that additional note. Okay, I see our guest. I'm not sure if Veronique Willey is unmuted, but Veronique Willey, are you a journalist? And could you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, Rolando, it's me. I'm sorry, I'm using my wife's computer.
John, you don't sound like Veronique.
It's John, yes.
Go ahead, John Zarakostas.
Yes. Hi, yes. My question was... to the UNEP spokesperson, the briefing on Thursday, will the Geneva Press be able to ask questions online or just to follow the webcast? Thanks very much.
Thank you, John. I believe you will be able to ask questions online, but I will actually double check and get back to you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Alejandro, once again, and good luck with this launch this week. Now we turn to Ms. Florence Bauer, who's UNFPA's Regional Director for Eastern Europe and Central Asia, who is here to speak about Ukraine. So over to you, and nice to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for this invitation. Great opportunity to be here with you today. So today I'm going to speak about an aspect of the war in Ukraine that is often overshadowed by the massive humanitarian crisis and by the political repercussion, and that's the demographic impact that the war is having on Ukraine. And here I want to start by reminding us that even before the escalation of the war, Ukraine was facing significant demographic challenges. The country had one of Europe's lowest birth rates. It has large number of people had already left the countries to look after other opportunities. The population was getting older and the total population was going down. And this is a situation that is not atypical in Eastern Europe, as many countries are going through similar kind of demographic trends. But with Russia's full-scale invasion that started in 2022, the situation got significantly worse. The birth rate plummeted and is currently at around one child per woman, which is one of the lowest in the world. At the same time, we have millions of people who have been displaced. We know that we have internally displaced people, and we have 6.7 million that are externally displaced as refugees. Some regions have been mostly depopulated, with young people leaving this region and some old people staying, and a significant number of people have died due to the conflict and of the war. So overall, what we can see is that the Ukraine population has declined by over 10 million since the beginning of the war. It also represents a massive loss of human capital that, as we know, is so key for the recovery and for building Ukraine's future. So that's why, as UNFPA, so our country office in Kiev, the government of, with our support, the government of Ukraine has developed and recently adopted a national demographic strategy to address these challenges. It's a strategy that takes into account experiences from other countries that have been narrowly focusing on increasing birth rates and that have failed. And instead, it's looking into a comprehensive approach and putting human capital at the center. It also recognizes that the solutions need to address broader socioeconomic factors, including access to caregiving, access to health, to education, and to create opportunities for young people and for families. And it's based on some of the successful examples, like in Sweden, where gender equality has been put at the center of such policies through parental leave for fathers, family-friendly work arrangement, and other kind of flexible arrangements that make it easier for women to be able to have children and a career if they wish so. So we can see that Ukraine had made already important progress with a law in 2021, for example, that has been promoting the shared caregiving and the participation of fathers. But of course, so much more needs to be done. It would be essential to have a census as soon as the security situation would allow to do so, because the last one was developed in 21. It's also required to have thorough demographic analysis to go more in depth and to understand how the demography is evolving. And Ukraine's path to demographic sustainability and resilience will require comprehensive approaches that focus as well on gender inclusivity and overcoming stereotypes and fostering economic opportunities for all citizens. And it will, of course, also be key to create environments for families and individuals so that they can navigate those demographic trends. And of course, above everything, a lot hinges on whether peace will return to Ukraine. But in the meantime, a lot can be done to strengthen the human capital of Ukraine so that the country can continue to build on its foundation and be better prepared for the whole recovery process. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you, Ms. Bauer. I should just highlight that we did share with you yesterday remarks from Miroslav Zhencha, who is with the Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, to the Security Council yesterday, through which he addresses the civilian casualties, extensive damage, including the attacks over the weekend, ongoing hostilities, as just referred to. And he also notes that next month will mark the 1,000 days of this devastating war. Those remarks of Mr. Zhencha were shared with you yesterday. We have a question for you from Yuri Aperlev of RIA Novosti. Yuri.
Yes, thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Florence. I just wanted to ask if you can send your notes about the topic that you present to us today to all the journalists. Thanks.
Absolutely, yes.
And colleagues in the room here will definitely take care of that as well. Yes, Nina, AFP.
Yeah, thank you for the briefing. I just wanted to double check. You were saying that the population in Ukraine has declined by 10 million since February 2022. Is that was correct?
The data we have is, of course, to be taken with caution as well, because, as we know, we don't have census and so on. So the estimates that we have is decreased by 10 million since even before 22. But we can give you an exact range of the number that we have.
Okay, thank you very much. You want to follow up? Yeah, go ahead.
Because, I mean, we've seen data before about a decline of 10 million since 2001. Yeah. Is that possible that that's it, or is it closer to 2022? Thanks.
Since the beginning of the war, so you would assume that it's longer, yes. It's probably the numbers that you have seen. Can I come back to you with the exact number, Emma?
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll get back to you with clarity on those figures. Okay, do we have further questions? Yes, we have Lisa Schlein of Voice of America online. Lisa.
Okay, yes, good morning. I'd like to pursue that a bit more because I'm confused. Could you break it down a little more systematically, the loss of population? Does it have to do with refugees leaving the country, with people actually being killed in the war itself? The birth rate is something else that's been going on another time. If you could be more specific about all of these, because it's really rather confusing. I mean, it's a startling figure. And since you were talking about it happening since the start of the war, I immediately thought, well, it has to do with the killings and the refugees and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a combination of factors. And again, we have to take into account that we don't have a census. But what we see, and it's important also to note that already before the war, that's something that you see happening in many of the countries of Eastern Europe, with young people leaving the countries, aging population, and shrinking birth rates. So what we have seen since the war, in particular since the full-scale escalation, is that the birth rates the fertility rate is around one. That's one of the lowest in the world, so well below the 2.1 theoretical reproduction rate. And what we have also seen, as you know, we have refugees, 6.7 million that are outside Ukraine, and we have a number of people who also move and go in and out, so that's an additional complexity to that. But of course, as you know, we have many young people who are also looking for other opportunities and going outside the countries. Within the countries, we see whole villages where you basically have only older people who don't want or cannot move, but where the young people has left the countries. And overall, there is, of course, as we can imagine, because of the situation of the war, the families are not in a position to be able to create a family. So it's a conjunction of factors. And in addition to that, you have the casualties that, as you know, it's difficult to have exact numbers of this, but the estimate range around several tens of thousands of casualties, which of course add to the equation. So it's a combination of factors that is putting a lot of demographic pressure on Ukraine and jeopardizing, I would say, the human capital and weakening the human capital that is so essential during the war and as soon as it will finish, hopefully soon.
Thank you very much, Florence. We have another question from Reuters. Thomas?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. So I just really want to be quite clear. So is that 10 million since February 22? The other thing I wanted to ask is, are these your estimates or are they based, or are you relaying estimates by Ukrainian authorities? And if they're your estimates, have you done similar for other countries in the region? I mean, notably Russia, of course. And actually, the third thing I would ask is, with 6.7 million abroad, do the neighboring countries have, do the countries where the refugees are currently living, do they have a role to play in addressing this demographic crisis? It would seem on the face of it that they do.
Let me answer part of the question. Initially, this is a number by the government on the reduction of the population, so that's one point. On your question on the refugees in the other countries, yes, we are, ourselves and other UN agencies, by the way, and other actors, we're playing a role also in the other nearby countries. I'll take one example, that is Moldova, where we are supporting the refugees through services on sexual reproductive health, prevention of gender-based violence, but also providing opportunities to young people. And this is, of course, done along the nexus. So there are, for example, youth centers that have been established in Moldova with our support, where in addition to being included into society and having access to the different services, they have those additional services that will enable them to develop skills and to continue to develop their competencies so that they can have the lives that they would like to have initially where they are now, taking continuing example of Moldova, for example, but also when they will go back to Ukraine. So definitely a lot can be done and is being done and has to continue to be done with the refugees in the neighboring countries so that investment in human capital will continue to be made so that it eventually also pays back for Ukraine.
Thank you very, very much, Ms. Bauer. I think that exhausts the questions on Ukraine. So, you wanted to add something? Yes, please, absolutely.
Can I just add on the question? I just ask clarification. So, the number is since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, okay? So, 10 million since beginning of full-scale invasion, it's a number from the government. You're welcome.
Okay, that's very good for that clarification. Thank you very much once again, and please do feel free to join us anytime. So thank you again. We have now, I'm told, that Ms. Noguchi, Chitose Noguchi, the Deputy Special Representative of UNDP, is online joining us from Gaza. The connection is not great, ladies and gentlemen, so I'm not sure how long we can keep her. But Ms. Noguchi, thank you very much for joining us from Gaza. Over to you for some brief remarks, and then we'll take as many questions as we can get in. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. It's really a pleasure for me to be connected from Gaza. I'm currently in Deir Bala, which is in the middle area, and which is where many of the displaced persons communities have been relocated, and many of the UN offices and non-government organizations are placed to provide services. I'm going to turn off my camera because I think the connection is not so great, and I do apologize if it gets cut off again.
That's understood. No problem. Thank you. Please continue.
I hope you can hear me well.
Yes, the audio is fine. So if you can continue, okay. If you can continue, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. So this month, we marked a full year of the war in Gaza, having been here a couple of times, I think the humanitarian catastrophe is really unfolding daily, and at a level that's surpassing anything in recent memory, leaving behind unprecedented numbers of casualties, widespread destruction, severe food insecurity, and mass displacement, as you have seen. We also have crippling restrictions on aid delivery, that has really compounded the crisis exponentially. We are today launching with ESQA an assessment that has new data, it's really highlighting the fact that we have a development emergency looming, and this is jeopardizing the future for all Palestinians, not only in Gaza. If we look at the economic figures, the economic losses are staggering. By the end of 2024, the GDP of the state of Palestine would have dropped from pre-war estimate of 20.2 billion to 13.1 billion, which is equivalent of over 35% reduction. Unemployment is skyrocketing. One in two people is jobless. In Gaza, unemployment rate is reaching 80%. Poverty is also exponentially rising. Three out of four people live in poverty. And in the state of Palestine, poverty is projected to rise to 74.3% in 2024, up from 38.8% at the end of 2023, which is affecting 4.1 million people, which includes 2.6 million people who have newly become impoverished. If we use another poverty metric, which takes into account other dimensions, such as freedom of movement and access to services, calculations indicate that the number of people in Gaza living in multidimensional poverty has risen to 97.9%. That's almost 100%. The state of Palestine is experiencing unprecedented setback in development, as measured by the Human Development Index, indicating a loss of almost 24 years of development gains. And as you're aware, the Human Development Index is looking at various aspects of the people's lives, which includes a long and healthy life, knowledge, as well as the standard of living. We are looking at figures that are showing that the state of Palestine is experiencing really unprecedented levels of setbacks. And this is for Gaza, reversing development by an estimated 70 years to the level equivalent to 1955. If we look at just humanitarian assistance flows at a rate of 280 million per year for 10 years, simulations, according to the assessment, show that humanitarian aid alone can't put Palestinian economy back on track to restore pre-war levels and align with the Palestinian development goals. The investments in development-enabling multi-sectoral recovery interventions, at least in an equal amount or more annually, must be secured. Recovery must be enabled to eventually support reconstruction of destroyed capital and restoration of lost livelihoods. Restrictions that are currently stifling the economy must be lifted, such as the movement of restrictions on Palestinian workers, as well as the withholding of clearance revenues due to the Palestinian Authority, contribute to improving the business climate. This would actually allow the private sector to contribute to recovery and reconstruction. So the reliance on recovery and reconstruction should not be just on ODA, but should be also the private sector being able to recover so that they can actually contribute to the process. The conclusion from the assessment is very important, not just for Gaza, not just for Palestine, but also for the Arab states region, as it's facing rising levels of war and crises. Home to less than 6% of the world's population, this region has witnessed 31% of global conflicts and originated 10% of the world's refugees. The call for simultaneous attention and investment in the dual tracks of immediate humanitarian aid and development-focused early recovery, this applies to many other contexts in the Arab region today. We as UNDP are already working on similar assessments in Lebanon, Syria, as well as other places in the region. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Noguchi. If you could share those notes with us, it would be most helpful. This really helps put this horrific situation in perspective. We do have a couple of questions, and please do let us know if you need to leave. I know you mentioned you don't have much time, but we have a question from Christiane of the German news agency in the room, and then we have another one online. Christiane.
Sorry, hello. Yes, we had similar reports in the last 2 weeks from UNCTAD and from ILO with similar but different figures. And that leads me to two questions. Do these UN organizations not work together? Is there a lot of duplication of analysis? Or does this contribute something that has not been presented in the other reports? Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Noguchi. Are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I was trying to unmute, but
okay.
It wasn't allowing me to.
Okay,
I can't.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much for your question. With regard to the different assessments and reports that are coming out from different agencies, we do coordinate and we do collaborate. As I mentioned at the beginning, the report, the socioeconomic impact assessment report that we are doing and are launching today is actually in partnership with ESQA. To your question earlier, the figures are being are in the report, and that is actually online, so that is shared with you, so that you have the actual figures. So in terms of the different numbers, we are making many assumptions when we do projections. So each report or assessment might have a different triangulation of data, different methodology for data collection, different analyses. But what we are always doing is to complement each other in terms of the different information that is coming together, for example, on the economy, on the unemployment, on poverty rates. Our assessment in terms of the socioeconomic impact assessment with ESQA is actually looking at a multi-poverty index, which is a unique measure that has been calculated and shared through this report. Of course, the HDI is something that is not in other reports. So there are unique aspects to our report. But as I mentioned, it's actually looking at different aspects and dimensions. And we are complement each other in terms of the comprehensive analysis. This actually does help us with our interventions and prioritization of our interventions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Noguchi. Okay, we have a few questions online. Jeremy Lange of Radio France International. Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you, Rolando. Just a quick one for Mrs. Noguchi. I think you mentioned the poverty level is could rise to 74%, nearly 75%. And then you mentioned another figure is 97%, almost 97.9%. If we consider multi-level of poverty, something like that. Can you explain the difference between the two? What is the multi-dimensional poverty and the poverty that you calculated? There's a 20% gap here, so I'd like to understand what is the difference.
Yes, Ms. Noguchi?
Yes, thank you for that question. So in terms of the figure of 74%, that is looking at poverty levels from an economic angle. So it's really looking at income poverty versus the multidimensional poverty index is a much more comprehensive figure that looks at access to services, including health, education, as well as freedom of movement. So there are many aspects that are incorporated into the multidimensional poverty index. And that is actually going to be available to you. So you'll be able to look at the specific dimensions and look at the differences in terms of the calculations and methodology for the calculations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Gabriela Sotomayor of El Proceso of Mexico. Gabby.
Hi, hello. Thank you very much, Rolando. Thank you, Ms. Noguchi. I didn't get what is the estimate or your estimate when will Gaza recover? It was before the war. Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of the recovery, we have estimated that if we look at the investments going into Gaza, the humanitarian aid itself, we've calculated we've done an assumption with $280 million per year. And then also in addition to that, $290 million a year for investments in development. And if that continues, then it could go back to pre-war levels in 10 years. However, that is based on many assumptions. And as you'll see in the report, we have different scenarios of the restrictions being a deciding factor. So, for example, if we don't have the access movement restrictions and materials going into Gaza to support the early recovery and reconstruction, we also don't have the clearance revenues going to the Palestinian Authority, then those would actually affect the outcome of the trajectory of recovery. So the report actually details different scenarios and what it would take for Gaza to recover pre-war levels. But if you have any technical questions, I'm sure my colleagues who are economists will be able to answer them much more from a technical perspective. Thank you.
Thanks for that offer, but I think it was quite clear, those comments, so thank you. We have one last question, John Zarakostas of France von Katt in The Lancet. John. John, are you here? Okay. Think you may, I'll tell you what, if you have problems with your connectivity, maybe you can pose a question in the chat, but I think this way may need to be the last question unless there are other questions in the room. And I remind you, we do have colleagues, Tarek is here in the room, and of course colleagues online, should you have other questions.
All right, can you hear me there, Rolando?
Now we can get you. Yes, John, please pose your question. Right. Thanks.
Yes. Question is to the representative from UNDP in Gaza. In your report, you mentioned that access to health, people unable to access health increased from 2.7 to nearly 30%. So does that mean the other 70% of the population in Gaza are having access to health? And secondly, I was wondering if you have a more up-to-date figure. In your report, you mentioned that 310 medical staff had been detained by the Israeli Defense Forces as of 30th of June. If you have an up-to-date figure, how many are still in detention as of October? Thank you very much.
Thank you for those questions. In terms of the health workers and health facilities and access to health facilities, that is probably best answered by our WHO colleagues, they would have the latest figures as well as the health cluster. So perhaps I could refer to them in terms of specific questions related to health. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Noguchi. And Tarek is in. I don't know if you had anything to add, Tarek, if you wanted. Not really. Tarek is nodding, and he will get back to you with these figures in the course of the day, I'm sure. Ms. Noguchi, thank you very, very much for joining us. And I know it's a bit of a effort to connect from Gaza. So thank you, and stay safe, and please do join us anytime. Thank you. All the best.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, colleagues, we have now Tarek on another subject, who has a guest with him, who's going to join us here on the podium. And then we will have one announcement from Tommaso at the end. If you want to come up as well, Tommaso, that would be fine. So we have Tarek with Ms. Dr. Janet Diaz, who's going to speak about Marburg. Over to you. Tarek, do you want to stay?
Yeah, thank you very much. And apologies, Dr. Rick Pieperkorn was unable to join as it has been planned. Dr. Pieperkorn was in a meetings planning for the last phase of the second round of polio vaccination campaign in Gaza. And John, I will come back to you on a question of number of detained health workers. I don't have it in front of me, but we've been repeating for last year that we always say that that right to health is one of the human rights, and unfortunately, people in Gaza have difficulties exercising that right because only half of the hospitals are partially functional. To get to hospital is very difficult. Movement is really difficult because of the infrastructure damage. The Ministry of Health has said that one 1,000 health workers have been killed, which is a really irreparable loss for the health system in Gaza. We do the best we can, and we will keep updating you on that. But today we wanted to tell you about something else. So you know all Dr. Janet Diaz, who is with us today. She's our lead on clinical management, and she has just returned from Rwanda. Maybe you have been following. Dr. Tedros went to Rwanda this weekend to see the progress in the response to the current Marburg outbreak, and Dr. Diaz was with him, and will tell us more on the situation in Rwanda, with specific focus on the clinical management of cases. Dr. Diaz also works on other diseases, so like Mpox, and you will probably remember that she also worked on long COVID, so she may answer those questions as well. But let's focus on Marburg first. Dr. Diaz.
Good morning. Good morning, colleagues, and thanks for having me here today. As Tarek already described, I lead the clinical management work here in the Health Emergencies Program at WHO, and I was part of the surge team that first went to Kigali to support the Ministry of Health in our country office a few days after the outbreak was declared, and I returned this past weekend with the honor of accompanying Dr. Tedros, our Director General, on his high-level mission. As of the 21st of October, in the current Marburg outbreak in Rwanda, there are a total of 62 cases and 15 deaths. One patient is still in treatment but recovering well. And there are two critically ill patients that have recovered from Marburg, but are still recovering from their critical illness and in treatment center. The majority of cases are in health workers infected during the two amplification events at the hospital in the city of Kigali. And there have been no cases or deaths in the past 7 days. So to echo what the DG said, Dr. Tedros' words over the weekend, it is really a commending the strong leadership of the government of Rwanda that enabled them to make rapid decisions and take actions and establish a multi-sectoral response to this Marburg outbreak. Specific to case management, which is what I want to focus on, a pathway for early recognition of cases was developed, early diagnostic testing with rapid turnaround of results, as well as the establishment of a treatment center that was safe to work in and that could provide quality clinical care. And that includes critical care services as well as mental health services. Soon after the outbreak started, the ministry-led response decided to establish a centralized treatment center at the Baho International Hospital, and two centers that would manage suspects, that means patients who were symptomatic, suspected for Marburg, but not yet confirmed, these centers, the suspect centers, could isolate patients safely, start early treatments, and also conduct rapid testing. The treatment center itself is able to care for up to 50 patients and has dedicated staff that are working there. There's almost over 150 staff, including general doctors, specialists such as ID physicians, internal medicine physicians, ICU physicians, emergency physicians, as well as nursing staff and general nursing, as well as intensive care nursing. The site also has infection prevention and control professionals, as well as teams that are dedicated to waste management, cleaning, disinfection, and decontamination, which is really important when managing an Ebola or Marburg or filovirus treatment center. A survivor program is also in place. I want to take a moment here to acknowledge the wonderful collaboration between WHO and its GORN partners that have been integrated into the National Case Management Pillar under the leadership of the Ministry of Health. The WHO experts brought high-level expertise with infectious disease, intensive care specialists, as well as health logistics from previous outbreaks, and have been working side by side with the local teams within the treatment center to ensure collectively as one team that we are providing safe care for patients and the best quality care as well. In particular, I want to talk about the two ICU patients which received invasive mechanical ventilation. These patients were extubated late last week, and that I think is something that was discussed by the Minister of Health and the DG at the press conference over the weekend. And I want to highlight that this did receive a lot of attention because it's a little bit more advanced treatment that we have been doing in previous filovirus outbreaks on the continent. But let's not forget that one of the major interventions for filovirus case management has been optimizing supportive care. And that piece of work has been going on for a decade with partners such as ALIMA, MSF, and in other partners within the countries that have had outbreaks. So we've been working to optimize care. And an example of that has been the ALIMA Cube that was used in the most recent filovirus outbreak responses, where we've been able to deliver oxygen therapy as well as non-invasive ventilation therapy. But what's different about what was able to be done here in Rwanda and Kigali was that the colleagues were able to use invasive mechanical ventilation for the Marburg patients, and those two patients have been extubated and now are recovering. Still a ways to go in their recovery, but doing better. Another hallmark event in this outbreak in Rwanda has been the initiation of the clinical trials on therapeutics. This success is also based on years of preparatory work led by the R&D blueprint here at WHO in collaboration with the MARVAC Consortium. And that group of folks developed a generic clinical trial protocol that was able to be quickly deployed to Rwanda and adapted by the national principal investigators and then approved in record time by the regulatory authorities of the country in Rwanda. This protocol started to enroll patients last week and I think is a big success in advancing the care for patients with Marburg disease. Finally, a word about the low case fatality ratio. There's also been mentioned that we're seeing, on the range of the lower range of case fatality ratio so far in this Marburg outbreak. And I think we will see by the end of the outbreak what the true CFR will be. However, and the ranges between CFRs has varied across different outbreaks from as low as 24% to as high as 88 or 90%. And there's many elements that that interplay to determine what the CFR is. But I say, even though we have a 24% CFR at this point, let's try to aim to do better. It is really important to continue to conduct robust clinical trials to find the most efficacious treatments and to combine that with the highest level of standard of care or optimized supportive care. So together with knowing the best treatment and the best standard of care, we can continue to drive down the mortality from this disease, which previously has had very high mortality. So we're happy to see it not so high and lower in this outbreak, but indeed we need to learn from this outbreak and then try to do better in the next one. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Diaz, for that very comprehensive, very useful brief. Do we have questions for Dr. Diaz? I don't see any in the room. No, I think you were absolutely very, very clear and comprehensive, no questions, but perhaps I trust that the notes will be sent, so thank you very much, and thank you once again, Dr. Diaz, for joining us here. Thank you very much. Okay, certainly last but not least, Tommaso of IFRC is here with an announcement.
Thank you, Rolando, and hi, everyone. As you may know, our statutory meetings, Red Cross and Kessen statutory meetings, started today, and I would like to update you on the next days what will happen. All our meetings will take place from today to the 31st of October at the International Conference Center of Geneva, the CICG, so basically on the other side of Place des Nations, as you know. Today we started with the IFRC Youth Forum, which is at the moment ongoing, and this Youth Forum brings young Red Cross and Kessen delegates together to discuss youth strategy and directly vote for the IFRC Youth Commission. The inclusion of youth voices in governance is critical for us and for decision making, and this is why the head of the Youth Commission will sit in the IFRC governing board, ensuring that youth voices are central to our discussions. Then from tomorrow to the 25th of October, we'll have the IFRC General Assembly, which is our highest decision making body for our under 91 National Red Cross and Crescent Societies. This year, among other topics, will be discussed the new health policy of the organization and the youth engagement strategy. And we also assess where we are with our strategy 2030 and discuss some constitutional amendments. And next week, as you know, we'll have the international conference, joined, of course, by ICRC colleagues and the governments who signed the Geneva Conventions. Journalists should already have received our media advisory, and thanks for the colleagues already answered. I would like to remind that you need accreditation to enter the conference center, so please drop us an email with your contact details and we'll get you a badge to enter. Regarding media opportunities, all the sessions are open to media. We are happy to support you in setting up interviews, and based, of course, on the angle that you want to cover. The IFRC priorities will be at the center of this discussion during plenaries, but also in other meetings, bilateral and so on. And just to name a few, protection of humanitarians, it's really critical this year, health, climate crisis, migration, and integrity. These will be all high on the agenda. You will have the opportunity to talk with humanitarians from literally all around the world, with first-hand stories from current emergencies. And of course, I mean, we heard a lot today about Middle East, climate-related disaster, I would say for us, Mpox outbreak, migration, just to name a few. So we look forward to working with all of you at the conference center. And if you have any question, I'm here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tommaso. Do we have questions? Yes, we do. John Zarakostas. Go ahead, John.
Yes, can you hear me there, Tommaso? Good morning.
We got you. Thanks.
Yep. Yeah, great. Yeah. I was wondering if you could please, I couldn't locate it, send us the list of the names of the delegates from the national chapters that are attending, at what level, if that's the Secretary General of the national chapters or the directors or whatever, so we can that way pick our selected interviews to come through you, if it's possible. Thanks very much.
Thanks, John. Sadly, I discussed with colleagues this request, but sadly, for data protection, we're not able to send the names of delegates. We can send the names of national society present and governments registered. Usually, the level of our delegations are presidents and secretary general of the different national societies, and in some cases, of course, the youth delegates, and in some cases, head of operations. Then it really depends on every single national society. And yeah, some delegations are bigger, some delegations are smaller. But of course, if you have any specific interest in some national society, I can link you with the national society and discuss it. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks. Gabby, El Proceso.
Yes, thank you very much. Hi, Tommaso. Are you going to discuss access to prisoners, for example, in places like Nicaragua or Venezuela?
As far as I know, to my knowledge, is not in the agenda, but this doesn't mean that there will not be discussion with participants with side events or bilaterals. So it's not something that I'm aware of, but I can check if you want. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, last question, Yuri Rianovosti.
Yes, hello, Tommaso. I just wanted to know if the Russian Red Cross is coming and at which level. Thanks.
Yes, Russia Red Cross is registered to the statutory meetings. For the level, I need to come back to you because I'm not really sure about it. Thank you.
Okay, lots of follow-up for you, Tommaso. So thank you very much for joining us here for the announcements. Good luck with this important meeting. That brings us to nearly the end of this briefing. Thank you once again, Tommaso. I just have a couple of announcements before, as usual, just to mention... keep you on track. The SG, as you know, was in Addis Ababa yesterday, where he took part in the 8th African Union. Actually, it's an annual UN annual conference taking place in Addis, the home of the African Union. So you have a number of documents that we shared with you in connection with the Secretary General's visit there, remarks at the inauguration of the renovated Africa Hall. Incidentally, in those remarks, he referred to the fact that Africa has no permanent seat on the Security Council, and he says, and let's hope it will be corrected soon, quote unquote. That's in one of the remarks shared with you. We also have the opening remarks that were delivered by the Secretary General at a press conference with Moussa Faki, the chairperson of the African Union, that we shared with you last night, a readout of the SG's meeting with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, was also shared. So that's a lot of material to go through in connection with the SG's visit. In terms of meetings here, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women is currently a meeting, as you know. Today there is an informal, sorry, not today, the 25th. That's this Friday, if I'm not mistaken, 25th of October. The CEDAW, as it's commonly known, is holding an informal public meeting with states parties in the launch of the General Recommendation Number 40 on equal and inclusive representation of women in decision-making systems. Very important issue. And during this session, as you know, they've reviewed Laos, Saudi Arabia, New Zealand, Chile, Canada, Japan, Cuba, and Benin. Human Rights Committee is also meeting, and this morning they are reviewing the report of Greece, and this afternoon it will continue reviewing France, which they began yesterday. Press conferences in this room at 2:30. We have the UN Trade and Development will be holding a press conference, rather, on the presentation of the Review of Maritime Transport 2024, Navigating Maritime Choke Points. Shamika Shiramane, who is UN Trade and Development's Director of Technology and Logistics, and Mr. Jan Hoffman, who is Head of Trade and Logistics at UNCTAD, will be here to brief you. A week from today, the 29th of October, we have another briefing from Trade and Development, and this one will be on the publication of the Trade and Development Report for this year, 2024, Rethinking Development in the Age of Discontent. That's the theme. Rebecca Greenspan, the Secretary General of UNCTAD, will be here to present this report along with Anastasia Nesvatilova, who is a head of macroeconomic and development policies branch. Almost done. Just to mention the flag that we did share with you, a press release and a report under embargo yesterday from the Global Ecosystems Atlas, which is a branch of the World Meteorological Organization. This to unveil, I believe the embargo was lifted at 10 a.m. this morning, but you do have the contents of the press release and the report itself. It was a report unveiled at the COP16 taking place in Cali, Colombia, as you know, speaking to the proof of concept of the Global Ecosystems Atlas. So that's something in your inbox. And lastly, quiz. What is this Thursday, 24 October? Come on, colleagues. 24 October. Free cup of coffee for anyone who gets it. UN Day. Come on, UN Day. It's our birthday. I'm disappointed in you. Okay, today, Thursday is UN Day, and we did share with you the Secretary General's message in multiple languages, as always, and he refers to many, many things, very important messages. He speaks of finding solutions to ease tensions, build bridges, and forge peace, eradicate poverty, deliver humanitarian relief is something we address commonly in this at this podium here. So lots of important messages in his UN Day message for 2024. I think that's it for me. Any questions? Gabby.
Thank you, Rolando. Are we going to have press conference with CIDO with the conclusions of their analysis of the countries?
That is, I'll check with my colleague to see if they actually, if we have something penciled in for them. Usually they do, but nothing to announce just yet. Certainly I'll check and we'll get back to you.